Welcome to the Gear Garage Live Show. This weekly YouTube show covers whitewater rafting, river safety,
oh God, I lost my paddle,
gear, and anything else Zach feels like rambling on about.
Well, welcome to the show, everybody. This is my sort of weekly Gear Garage Live Show, where I answer questions that have been submitted. There's been a lot of questions the past week. I'm personally headed to our trips in Bhutan. I'm in Bangkok right now, so if the internet is slow or, I don't know, I'm not sure these headphones work that well, please let me know if the audio is okay. Hopefully you can hear through the microphone in these headphones. And yeah, let's just get to questions and what we have planned for the day. Oops, not that. Where was it going to? Wait, was that it? Sorry, everyone. Let's add this. Oh, man, I'm messing up. I'm already doing a bad job. How do I add the slide? Uh-oh. There we go. Cool. We got our questions. Thank you for being patient. So first of all, I do want to talk about our Bhutan trips because I am headed there. Just to give a quick plug for those. We do cultural and paddling trips there. Our best itinerary, that one I think is the best, we're there 9 days. We stay in hotels every night, so it's not camping. And we do 3 half-day rafting trips. And they're really efficiently done. So the rafting is on route to somewhere. We're not like driving out of our way. So we're able to mainly see the country. The main reason you would want to go to Bhutan is culturally. It's culturally amazing. We go see a lot of the cool spots, the high points that people want to see. But also get off the beaten path quite a bit through some cool hikes we do. And also the rafting trips. The rafting trips aren't the main goal of the trip. I mean, people can kayak too. We have, you know, kayaking's available. We have kayaks over there. People kayak too or raft. That's not the main reason we're there, but we do it. We usually do a 3 days of our 9 day trip, 3 half-days. We're not even full days of rafting. So if you ever want to go to Bhutan, want to do a little bit of boating, it's a good mix. We have another itinerary we're doing this year, and I might keep doing it, where we're doing 2 half-days of rafting and a 3 day overnight trip. And it's a cool overnight trip. Culturally, you're basically flowing through a national park, but we don't see many people. The one place we do stop is this really unique village in southern Bhutan. So it's culturally interesting in that we're in the middle of nowhere. But you're going to see fewer of the cool temples, see less of the history, see less of the people with the overnight trip. But it is an overnight trip. And an overnight trip in the Himalayas is something special. Like we can have bonfires, right? Like you just can't do that in the U.S. You know, there's big sandy beaches. There's plenty of wood. And so we can just have a massive fire. We don't have fire pans. We treat the leave no trace principle, which is minimize campfire impact. We minimize it, but we still can have a bonfire, which is kind of fun. So anyway, if you're ever interested in those trips, let me know. I'm really proud of them. I think this is my 13th time going there, and we've probably run 20, 25 trips. I have to count over my 13th visit there doing trips. So that's that. Let's get on to questions. Also, if you have questions separate than the show, put them in the comment section. I have questions I'm going to get to. I'll answer questions as we go. I added this new thing where new comments will appear in the screen. So hopefully that works. It'd be cool to see that. Okay, here we go. November Rogue. I was looking at doing a float at the end of November on the Rogue River in Oregon. Is that even a realistically feasible thing to do? Yeah, you can pretty much do the Rogue year-round. Like, I don't think you ever can't do the Rogue. Maybe if like there's a crazy snowstorm, you may not want to go, but you should be able to get to the put in the takeout. I've done January trips. I think I've done March a couple times. I think I've done February once. It's really nice to go. I've never done November, but it's probably an awesome time to go. The beautiful thing about doing winter trips is that there's hardly anybody out there, so you can camp pretty much wherever you want. It's really green. The creeks are running. If it's raining, the creeks are beautiful. It's just an awesome time to go. So I highly recommend it. It can be cold, so you just have to be ready for cold. That's pretty much it. And if so, are there any specific portions that you know of that would be best, or is the Alameda to Foster Bar the only option to run the river? I was just assuming you were going to do the overnight section from, yeah, Alameda to Foster Bar. Yeah, that's like the best. Yeah, I mean, you could do the day section or whatever. You can do other parts of it, but like, Alameda to Foster, you know, I'd probably do Grape Creek to Foster in the winter just because it's cold. I'd want shorter time on the river, maybe. But wherever you put it doesn't matter. That's just, that is the section. And it's awesome. It's one of the few overnight trips that can be done year round. Good question. Have fun out there. That's going to be sweet. Okay, winter boating. I was wondering if you have done an informational podcast discussing specifics for late fall winter rafting and the difference in needed supplies for that type of rafting. You know, I don't remember. I've done so many videos and podcasts that I don't remember everything I've done. So I'm going to just Google for you. And let me move this, add this, and have this video open that somebody sent that we'll go over later. But let's type in Gear Garage videos or podcasts about winter boating. I'm sure I've talked about it. I'll hear AI is saying. Well, here's one about winter boating stuff you would bring. So this might be one. This repair first aid and safety kits. This live show came up. That's live streams. Let's see. Safety cover, Chinese rafts, runs, go prep, turn mount. Nope. I'm sure Aaron and I in an Aaron and Zach show talked about it. If you just search Google, you'll find it. Here's a good video somebody else did. Useful cold weather boating tips to keep you safe. I'm sure Aaron and I have talked about it off and on in different podcasts. The best way to find stuff like this is just go to Google and find out if I've done it. I don't remember. I'm not like a catalog for my videos. I make them, put them out there, but I don't have like a library where I can get them to you. I'll just say, like, if you're going to go fall, winter, raft, I'll just answer this question. In terms of what you probably want, the main difference is dress. You're going to probably want a wetsuit or a dry suit. Depends how cold it is. Not everybody can afford a dry suit because they're, $500 to $1,500. And a wetsuit is actually in some ways superior to a dry suit. I'm not going to get into that now because that's a whole separate massive topic. But you need a wetsuit or a dry suit just for safety. If you fall into the cold water, it's a hazard. But also, like, it'd be cold on the raft potentially. And so for comfort, you'll want that. And then, layers, you'll want to have fleece layers underneath, have good things to keep your feet warm, maybe some hand warmers. I don't know. So you want personal comfort, but also personal safety in terms of, if you fall in the cold water. And the other thing, if you're camping, doing overnight trips, you probably want like tarps and good tents. And because it can get really cold when it rains out there. So good waterproof tents, like three season tents, tarps so you can be outside when it's cold, and then probably a fire. It's really nice to have a fire when it's raining. So hopefully that answers your question. Again, this video, I'm gonna go back to this YouTube. Let me remove this. This video right here that came up first, repair. Oh geez, here's a commercial. Anyway, that video, repair first aid and safety kits for winter boating, is probably what you're looking for. Okay, cool. Moving on. Let's go back to here. And you can see right there, that's cool. Craig has a question that came up in the comments. I'll get to that in a little bit, Craig. Thanks for adding that in. Okay. Yeah, this is a long one. Let's go to a different view so I can read this better. Good morning. When I was in the process of building my boat, a Highside Pro 16 XT, I chose the Sawyer MXLG for a set of oars. I used your equation to decide an oar length. Highside Pro 16, good boat. Sawyer MXGs, I think, are the best. And using my equation for oar length, smart. Awesome. I love it. Distance between oar locks is 89.125 inches. That's a lot. That's a lot of distance between oar locks. Multiplied by 1.63 is a blah, blah, blah. 12 feet. Yeah. And 12 feet, that's, I don't even know if they make 12 foot oars. And I don't think 12 fedoras are a good idea. So before I get to the rest of your question, I'm just going to say, like, you really can't run 12 fedoras. It's just, it's not realistic. And so what I would try to do, you just have to run short oars, like maybe run 11s just because that's what they make. Try to reduce the distance between oar locks. The Highside Pro 16 XT is a wide boat. I think it's like 4 inches wider maybe than similar 16-foot boats. So it's already a wide boat. And so if your oar locks are also like on the outside, That's just for a long distance between your airlocks. So you're going to want to, I mean, you probably already bought the frame. You're not going to buy a new frame, but I would, I mean, with this boat, if you're just going to run like the Rogue class 2 and 3, go do like Deso and Gray, go do what, like Westwater once in a while, like just do like class 2 and 3 stuff. Just throw a 10 and a half 11s on here. You're going to be fine. It's not optimal, but because you have a wide boat and a super wide distance to your oarlocks based on the frame that you bought, you're going to be fine. It's not optimal. It's what a lot of people are doing, so it's fine. If your goal is to go run the Illinois, the Selway, high water middle fork of the salmon, the Tuolumne, you need to fix that frame setup. The frame's just too wide. And I'm sure somebody sent you, let's look at what Highside sells. I'm going to remove here. Let's see what Highside, what was that boat again? Highside Pro 1690. All right, I'm back. Yeah, sorry everyone. As I was going through my trying to open this Highside page, I killed the tab that was doing this. Okay, so I'm back here. Let's share screen to the Pro Highside 16XT. So this is the Highside website, and see if they recommend a frame. I feel like they do. You can see, like, look at this photo right here. I can just tell those oarlocks are really wide. Those oars are pretty long. This one, they recommended a frame. Like right here too, this frame is classic. See how that frame, like that tube sits on the, it's already a wide boat. The frame sits on the outside of the tube and those oar towers extend out more. And so those oars that he has, to me, look like too short. Like when his arms are up, they're spread out too wide. So I can already tell his oars are too short. Those might be 11s or 10 and a halfs. It's just because the oarlocks are so wide, it's hard to get the geometry correct. Let me see if they have a frame. See this one, they recommended a frame somewhere for this boat. Let's see, let's search. Highside Pro 16 frame. Oh, the search didn't work. Oh, here we go. Highside. Not very good with the internet today, but let's just look at one of their frames. And I think here's a good example. I don't know which boat this is for, but I'm not a big fan of this frame setup. First of all, like, and we're going to go over some things I know are controversial. Oh, I got to. Why is it not showing this photo? I'm having a hard time with the internet, everybody. Oh, you're okay. Sorry, I'm here. So this is the photo I was talking about, where the oar towers are really wide. And I'm gonna throw in this page I found. Guys, I'm sorry, I'm technically challenged today. There's just a bunch of browsers open, and I keep opening and closing things to make them show up in the right place. Let's put this here. This is the frame. Can we see this? Just make sure I'm here. Yeah, this is the frame the Highside recommends. And I'm just not a big fan of this frame. I don't think this is a good frame. Now, again, like I want to go back. Like if you're running class 2 and 3, Desolation, Westwater, maybe the Rogue sometimes, maybe like a regular middle four trip, like this is probably adequate. You're going to be fine. You don't need to stress out. But this seat is just too high. I know people love these big captain's chairs. But once you have this big captain's chair, it really messes with all the geometry of everything. Because then your oar towers have to be high. if you further away, spread out, it's just kind of messy. You really want to sit lower. Again, if you're doing class two and easy three, comfort's nice, get the big captain's chair, you're going to be fine. If your goal is to have better rowing performance, this chair is just too high. And these oar towers are on the outside of a, of the outside rail, really far away. You can see, like, I don't know if you can see these oar towers. They're not only just not on the frame, which is already wide, on a boat that's already wide, they're also outside of it even more. And so this frame dictates a really wide distance between oar locks, which then leads to optimal oars that are in the 11, 12 foot range. So I think the issue is the frame and on top of the boat being already wide. Okay, so let's open up the question again. I have to reload some stuff, everyone, here. So let's get back to the question. Give me a second here, move that. And while this loads, I have to load the questions again. Craig asked, I'll get back to the previous question. Looking for a good 2-night, 3-day overnight to test my drift boat prior to Grand Canyon in April, probably January, February. I mean, in Oregon, I'm guessing Oregon. January, February, the Rogue. I mean, maybe the John Day or the Grand Ron, but they're probably really cold. Maybe too cold. I know people do the John Day in the winter, or I mean the Grand Ronde, but for an overnight rafting trip in the winter, I just don't think you can beat the Rogue. Okay, so back to this question. Okay, so I just went on like a long diatribe about a bunch of stuff. The bottom line is the Highside Pro 16XT, great boat. It is wide. So if you throw a wide frame on that already and then put the oar locks and put the oar towers even further away, right, you're going to have a really large distance between the oar locks, which I think is what you have, which leads to 12-foot oars. Well, I don't think 12-foot oars are a good idea on any boat, unless it's like a 20-foot boat or something crazy, right? Our 18-foot rafts that we use for our overnight trips, the frames are set up so that the equation gets you 11-foot oars. So again, our 18-foot boats have frames that lead to 11-foot oars. And I've got, and the math actually is like 10.8 or something. So you can run 11s or 10 and a half. So a lot of guys run 10 and a half. I like the 11s. You, because of the frame setup, are needing 12s, which is just a lot. It's just a lot. So I'm not a fan of that. I would fix the frame, which I've said a few times. I just want to reiterate that. But if you have the raft, you have the frame, and you have to put oars on it, I go 11. And they're going to be short, but it's fine. You're just going to be at somewhat of a disadvantage from optimal rowing conditions. That's just how the reality. So let's move on. My oar length, I got to get rid of this little question thing. I'll keep reading. My oar length based on your calculation would be 12.1 feet. I reached out to Sawyer, specifically Sawyer Station, and placed an order with an associate 3 times MXLG oars in red, 12 feet in length. Okay. A bit later, I get a call from them telling me their machine is not able to make a 12-foot oar and a maximum of 11. Yeah, exactly. Like, that's what they can make. I decided to go with 11-foot as I wanted the MX. I got to get rid of the screen, everybody. I'm sorry. This like comment thing is super cool, but I can't read. I got to pull the thing up. This is going to be one of the worst episodes I've ever done. I read off a different thing. There have been a couple. Okay, I decided to go with 11-foot length because I want an MXLG or awesome. I think that's your best choice. There have been a couple of examples of people in similar situations using your oar length calculation coming up with a similar length as I did. In response to those questions, we'll see off the cuff, that's too long of an oar. It should be about 10. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a general rule of thumb, and I'm a huge advocate of this 1.63 thing, right? Distance between the oar length times 1.63. It really does work for optimal oar length, right? But I also, like, a general rule of thumb to me is like a 16-foot boat generally uses 10-foot oars. Generally. So when you start like that equation, that 1.63 generally leads to 10, right? Based on most frames. So once you go to 12, you're off by a few feet. And so I would probably go, 10 and a half. That's what I said earlier, 10 and a half, 11-foot feet. It's just 12 feet's a long oar. I've submitted this before. It was asked if I wanted you to answer it on your YouTube show, and I said, wait, I have submitted this before and was asked if I wanted you to answer it on your YouTube show, and I said no. Okay, I just saw another Erlang video you posted on YouTube and want to get clarity around how you can be so exact in your detail of the equation and shooting from the hip when pressed regarding real world examples. So my equation is not that exact. This, and maybe I'm not explaining it well, or I'm not like writing about it well. I think I am. Or maybe people who are reading about it are, because I hear this a lot, that it's so exact. But if you read what I write, it says that 1.63 is a starting point. Historically, what the shops have been telling people is multiply by 3 and divide by 2, which is the same as multiplying by 1.5, right? Well, what I found in my courses when I teach people is everybody's ORs are like too short. So it's happened to me so many times that I just bring, if I know somebody has a 13-foot boat, I'll bring a couple exercises of ORs, let them play with their ORs, swap them out with longer ORs, and pretty much every time they're like, yeah, those are better. So I've just noticed that like what shops are selling people have been at least half a foot too short across the board. This is like 5 years ago before I even had my Erlang equation. So then I went out and I studied a bunch of different, I looked at like really good boaters and our commercial stuff, other guys' commercial stuff, and I measured ORs, distance between OR locks and OR length. I did this on probably like, I don't know, 30 different setups across states, across outfitting companies, both private and commercial, both class five cataracts and gearboats. And everybody who was like really solid was in this like 1.6 to 1.7 range. And if you average it all out, you got 1.63. So I went with that. And I actually wanted to go with 1.618 because I think that number is like the magic. It's called something like the magic number or the, I don't know. There's some number of beauty within math. And I like 1.618 would have been the best number possible. But the average of all was 1.63. And so I decided to go with what I found instead of what I wanted it to be. But they're so close, it doesn't matter that much. And the key here is that is the best starting place for your ORs. Instead of multiply by 3, divide by 2, which is just made up. I honestly think people just made that up, right? I don't think it's even real, which gets you 1.5. I took a sampling of everybody out there and got to 1.63. So I think that's better. And I've tested it since then on a bunch of boats. Every time I go boating, I do the equation, take that OR. I'm super happy. Now, whenever I describe this, both in a video and I just wrote a blog about this, I make it clear you should add or subtract half a foot based on a number of factors. Big tubes, long torso, weird seat, your own OR management. There's a, like, if you look at, like, it's amazing. Like, my equation is very simple. There's actually like a ton of factors that go into OR length. And I sat down and I, because I'm a math guy, like I studied engineering, I worked out the equation of OR length based on like seat height, tube diameter, all these things. And I found that they only mattered, like all those things combined only mattered like 10%. What really matters is the distance between OR length. So instead of giving everybody this like super complicated equation, and nobody, you know, most people couldn't even do the math on, I go, oh, let's just simplify this to what matters and make 1.63 the starting point instead of 1.5. Now, you think it's my equation is exact. Wait, I submitted this before. Anyway, my equation is super exact. It's just because I go to 2 decimal points, maybe you think that. No, it's just like, that's just what I think. That's just the best answer I got, right? Like when I'm on trips, this is how I work. When I'm guiding trips, you know, I'll tell people a lot of times, hey, we're leaving camp at 10:12. That's honestly my best guess of when we're leaving camp. Instead of saying just 10, I'm giving people the best guess I have. 1.63 is the best starting point I have. And the goal of this equation is so that people have a better starting point than 1.5. So the real thing is like 1.63 plus or minus half a foot. Now yours got to 12. And so you subtract half a foot, you still get to 11 and a half. But I would probably go to 11 just because I don't know if they make 11 and a half footers. And I would go with that. And so it's exact, but there's some wiggle room for sure. And I hopefully, everywhere I've described this equation, do multiple videos, multiple live shows like this, the blog post I just wrote, hopefully I'm really clear that like it's a starting point, plus or minus half a foot. You're in a unique situation again, because I think your frame's super wide. Okay, so back to the rest of your question. Hopefully I explained that pretty well, and that's why I can shoot from the hip, because like I have a sense of what's going to work and not going to work. The one on your frame, the 1.63 is just not going to work because your frame's too wide. So the best I can tell you is like a normal 16 usually has 10 foot orders. You have a wide 16, so go 10 and a half, 11. That's the best you can do. But my real answer is maybe you need a different frame with narrower orlocks. Okay. The distance between orlocks is the question. My towers are inside of the tubes. Okay. So the L is turned outward. Yep. I could flip them to decrease the distance between the orlocks. You definitely want to decrease the distance between orlocks. I don't know if flipping them is a good idea. I've never done that. But yeah. Let's say I was able to reduce the distance between orlocks by 5.5 inches using this your calculation. That would give me a length of 11.5. Technically, my orders are still too short. However, Sawyer can't make them longer unless I want to use an extension. You don't want to use an extension. It would just be a... And another thing, when you have orders in that like 11 out of 12 foot range, there's just... There ends up being so much flex. I don't think you want that flex. In real world, I do use an 8-inch tower. I've been on 2 multi-day trips using a setup and it seems to be okay. Yeah. I mean, purchase orders are too short. No. If again, like I think you're fine. I mean, try moving the orlocks inward, maybe. But if it's fine, it's fine. Like it's not optimal. I'm just gonna say it's not optimal. If you want optimal, and I think optimal matters the most. If you're gonna go, if your goal is running white water, you want to go do like a high water middle four trip, or like I said, the Illinois or the Selway. Or the Tuolumne, or something like that, you really want optimal. If you're mainly just doing like 2 and 3, doing the shoots, I don't know what you're doing, this is fine. It's not optimal, but it's fine. And I think the only way to make it optimal, honestly, is get a different frame. I think that's, and I don't have a good recommendation for a frame right now, but I would try to get a frame with a lower distance between the orlocks. Okay, hopefully I answered that question. Let's get back to Craig. The shoots, I don't know. I've never done the shoot. I've only done the day strip once. I've never done the overnight. I don't know if you can do in the winter. Good question. I don't know. Oregon, Washington. Honestly, the Rogue, and or just go do day trips on the Rogue. You can do a quick overnight trip. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Next question. Or tethers. Zach, thanks for all you do to educate the wireboard community. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for saying that. I do get a lot of flack about saying things, so it's nice to hear good things because people sometimes get upset with me for having an opinion. I really appreciate the time and thoughtfulness you put in your content. Thank you. I'm an aging kayaker, and I've recently started rowing my – let's get to this question. My RMR Fat Cat with oar frame and Sawyer oars. The oar tethers that I see marketed do nothing to hold me in the raft. Yeah, I mean, or all the oar tethers are just like in their simplest form. It's just a rope that attaches your oars to a frame. That's all oar tethers are in their simplest form. Like the goal of oar tethers is if your oar pops out, it doesn't float away. You're just tying your oar to your boat. So I just use rope. I actually use like a 1/2-inch webbing and just tie a bowline on the frame, bowline on the oar, and I've run that. It's cheap. It's easy to fix. You just have to know how to tie a bowline, right? But if you want to buy oar towers, you can too. There's different oar towers for sale. I think just a piece of rope is fine, but they don't do anything to hold you in a boat. It's absolutely true. And that's why people use pins and clips, because the clip catches, and so it can hold you in the boat. Oar towers just slide out and you fall out of the boat. I made my own looping 1-inch strap over the oar and cutting a slot in the bottom of my convertible oar right, then attaching the buckle. What? I made my own looping 1-inch strap over the oar, cutting a slot in the bottom of my convertible oar right, and then attaching the buckle to the motor. Okay. This is working great for me, but because I do not see anyone using this, I wonder if there's something bad that I am not thinking of. I really appreciate your feedback on my simple rotator system. Okay, so there's a video that goes with this. I'm going to play the video. I haven't seen the video yet. Hopefully, I didn't lose it in all my opening and closing of, here we go, of Windows. I have it right here. So let's see what this video is all about. Give me a second, everybody, with my lamest episode I've ever done because I'm just a mess. Okay, here we go. I'm going to play this. I'm going to go to the beginning. Hopefully you guys can hear this.
My name is Larry Whalen. I'm a RMR fat cat boater and been working on oar tethers. And I wanted your feedback on something I did. I don't know why it's bad. I'm wondering if it is. Check this out. So I took a pair of NRS loop straps, looped them around my oar, and I cut a slot in the bottom of my oar right. And then I just sewed a shorter loop and have it half hitched through my oar tower, and then a simple NRS buckle there, so that when I'm in my boat and I, you know, fall this way, I've got it, it stops me. And if for some reason I were to pop one out, I do have to go, you know, if I pop an oar, I have to go back to that buckle and release it in order to put the blade back in and then put the oar back in the oar lock. But I'm trying to figure out why this wouldn't work. I've paddled it a number of times. I love it. It's working great for me. I have popped an oar, unfortunately drug a downstream paddle blade and had an oar pop. Wasn't a thing. Like I say, hit the buckle, released it, put it back in the oar lock, was able to finish out that rapid and then resecure it with the oar tether. I'd appreciate your feedback. I appreciate your time. Thanks for what you do. Hey, Zach, my name is Larry Whalen. I'm
okay. Sweet. Let's actually fast forward to like the, this is what it looks like. There we go. I think this is sweet. I don't know if anybody out there has an opinion on the live show right now. I want to share your opinion in the comments. I don't know. It seems a good idea to me. I think the only improvement I would do, and it's been done, is instead of using a strap for this, use a bungee. So it stays pretty tight, but it can extend out a little bit. But I think this is super cool. I can't think of any negative feedback. I think that my only slight concern is, you know, because you have, if you pop an oar, it's just gonna take longer to put the oar back because you have to open that strap, which isn't a big deal. That's just a choice you're making. So like if I was running this on class 5, I would have some hesitations. I liked it keeping me in the boat. But sometimes you pop an oar, you need to get back in fast, and to have to take the time to fidget with that strap, it's a trade-off. Stay in the boat or fidget with the strap. I think the solution for this really, though, is the oar snubber. And so there's been different versions of this. Let me see if I can find it. Here we go. Everybody see this? I think this oar snubber is basically that, but it has the bungee. And so, I mean, I love this video because this is the problem. I see so many people with their spinnies, they're holding on to the oar, which they should. This happened to me last year. That's a great job holding on the oar, but the oar, which can keep you in the boat, falls out. I love this video. It's so sweet right here. Right. And it's good form to hold on to your oars. Like I see a lot of people rowing, especially people that row spinnies, whenever they get stable, they let go of the oars and grab their frame. I just think that's terrible form. Your oars are what you use to propel yourself down the river. Like to let go of them and let them flap around. They could catch a rock and blow out. They could break. They could hit you. Like your oars are dangerous things. What he does here is awesome. He holds onto his oar to the bitter end. I'm super impressed by this video. What oar snubber guy did is, and I'm a pins and clips guy. Like I'll run or whatever, but like I like pins and clips. He took it and he made this. So this is the oar snubber. It's basically what you have, right? But this is a bungee right here. And so, and you can pull it out and get the oar back in fairly easy. And so, Larry, what you did's cool. I think the oar snubber is just a slight improvement over what you did. And I think what you did and the oar snubber, honestly, in my opinion, is optimal. I would go with something like that personally. So yeah, cool job. That's sweet. Okay. Next question. Yo, brother, I hope this finds you well. I watched a video on whitewater versus saltwater rescue. From my personal standpoint of a kayaker and rafter and also a first responder, I fully agree. That's some excellent information. I would also love to come and sit in a class if you don't mind. I teach out guys, would love to see from a different perspective. Yeah, so just to go, like, I did a video that just came out a few days ago about the difference between whitewater and saltwater rescue. And I'm seeing this two ways. I'm telling our guides they need to take rescue courses. And so they go out and take a rescue course. And when they come back, and they spend their money, I say, I don't make them take it. They just get a financial incentive to take it. But they should take it. I encourage them. They come back and they've learned things. They spent their money and their time. And what I expect to be a class that's really suited for their needs. And they come back and like half the stuff they did are just kind of useless. They're techniques to rescue people in rivers, but not something boaters use. I'd say half, honestly. And sometimes they're hearing things that are just wrong. Things taught in rescue classes are wrong. So I've been doing a deep, deep dive personally into rescue classes to figure out why. And I just took my own rescue instructor course. And a couple of things I've learned. One is it's not that hard to become a rescue instructor. There's different organizations that do it. Some are more strict than others. Some it's actually fairly easy. And when you take a rescue instructor course, they're generally 5 days or longer. You're not learning all your rescue techniques there. You're learning how to teach and you're watching other instructor candidates teach. So you're learning a lot of stuff from other instructor candidates, not the like instructor teacher. And so the content, what people are teaching in rescue classes is just based on what they think and what they've learned. And there's not like a really solid, like, here's the best way to swim white water. Here's the right way to deal with the rap. There's just a lot of opinions out there. And some of these opinions are just factually wrong, which is kind of frustrating to me. And then I've also realized that there's whitewater rescue and swiftwater rescue. And so if you go take a swiftwater rescue course, the idea of swiftwater rescue is that an accident's already happened and a team is called to deal with the accident. Later, like time is going to pass, and generally the victim is not a boater. It's just somebody who got stuck in a river, stuck in a rock. They're not dressed in PPE, and a team is going to show up and rescue that person. And the first responders are not boaters. They're just like they're firefighters who've been trained, and they're well trained, but they're all about ropes and trucks, and they have a lot of equipment, right? And so if you're learning rescue in that style, you're learning a lot of techniques that I don't think apply to whitewater. And the victim could have been there for a half an hour or a day. And a lot of times the victim is a dead person. A lot of the stuff people learn in swiftwater rescue is body recovery techniques. So, which is good knowledge to have, but usually when somebody's dead, that's when those of you on the river probably aren't dealing with the pinned person anymore. That's when you call 911 and a swiftwater team comes out who's been trained on that. As boaters, if we want to be better at safety and rescue, we should take what I'm calling, and other people call it too, but I'm trying to rebrand it as whitewater rescue, which is like we're all going boating, we're going down the river, and what are techniques we can learn to deal with preventing accidents first? Because again, swiftwater rescue, the accident already happened. In whitewater safety and rescue, we can, if we have some ways to prevent the accident, it just never happens. But then once it happens, what are some techniques we can have with the equipment that we have with us as boaters and our skill set being able to navigate the rivers, whether it's in boats or swimming, because a lot of boaters are really good swimmers because we're in the water a lot. So to me, it's two different classes. And so I did a video about this, and then whoever sent this comment, thank you for backing me up. Like, I really feel strongly about this, that in the whitewater, in the rescue world, as boaters, we should be taking a class more whitewater rescue specific. And when people say, people ask the question all the time, how do I become safer? And somebody says, take a Swiftwater class. It's going to make you safer, hopefully, maybe, probably. But it's going to be 2 to 3 days and a lot of money that can be better spent to make you even safer by taking a class specific to whitewater with whitewater techniques. So anyway, this is a comment about that. And it was an interesting video. If you guys are curious, please watch it. Please comment on it. Because I think that what we need more is whitewater rescue courses taught by experienced whitewater boaters, whether it's private boaters or guides. Like, ideally, an experienced private boater should be teaching other private boaters rescue classes. An experienced professional guide should be teaching guides rescue courses, and not like a firefighter teaching us how to do rescue, or somebody who was a guide for maybe a year and now teaches rescue to kayakers, raft guides, private boaters, special forces. Like, you know, like, you want somebody who's been a guide for a long time over a, if you're getting guided rescue, who's guided over a variety of places, big water, low volume, class 2, 3, 4, 5. Or if you're a private boater, you want somebody who's done the things you're doing, who does overnight trips, who's done the rogue, done the middle fork, who can give you the techniques you need to run those rivers more responsibly. And if you have a question about, like, what happened this one time on the middle fork, this person did this, and how do I deal with that? Well, if you're a rescue instructor who's never done an overnight trip, it's really hard to answer that question. So anyway, those are my thoughts about rescue, and thank you for whoever left that comment out there. So I think that's the end of the episode. Thank you, everybody, for watching, and hopefully I answered the questions well enough. And thank you, Craig, for asking about an overnight trip. Good luck with that. Again, I just go on the road, and I'll be in Bhutan for the next 2 weeks. And if questions pile up, I may do a show. Otherwise, I might wait till I get back later in November. Anyway, thanks, everybody. See you next time.